Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Linda Bell. I'm an assistant federal defender for the District of Nevada, and I represent William Scott Manciano, the appellant in this case. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I will keep an eye on the clock. This case involves 4 certified issues stemming from the ineffectiveness of Mr. Manciano's trial counsel. Mr. Manciano also presented an uncertified issue that this Court has asked for some additional briefing on. I plan to focus my comments this morning first on one of the ineffective assistance of counsel's issue, that is the failure of counsel to convey a plea offer to Mr. Manciano prior to going to trial, and then on the uncertified issue, which is the lack of evidence of express malice to support a conviction for attempted murder. Mr. Manciano's counsel in this case failed to convey a plea offer prior to trial. He provided Mr. Manciano with an affidavit that said that there was an offer of 2 to 10 years, and in a case where Mr. Manciano was facing approximately 70 years exposure, he was convicted and was sentenced to 43 years. The lawyer said that he was unsure whether he conveyed the offer because he was focused on going to trial. And Mr. Manciano indicates that the lawyer never discussed the plea offer with him.
Ms. Bell, may I spell out for you a problem that I see just so that you can respond to it? We're looking at this through the lens of AEDPA. Okay, so the question is, at least the initial question is, did the Nevada Supreme Court's determination, was it contrary to clearly established Supreme Court precedent? So when you look at the papers that were before the Nevada Supreme Court, there is no evidence of prejudice at all, because the affidavit that Manciano submitted says nothing whatsoever about what he would or could have done. His brief does say he could have looked at the had an opportunity to consider the offer and could have accepted it. But my problem is the Nevada Supreme Court, well, it might have said, well, could's good enough, didn't. And why is that clearly contrary to Strickland?
Your Honor, I think that if we look at the process by which the Nevada Supreme Court got to that decision, it is clear that it is something that this Court does not need to defer to.
Why?
And the reason is that Mr. Manciano initially presented a claim that there was a plea offer, his lawyer did not get it to him, and he could or would have taken the deal had he known about it. Which is something that this Court in Nunez said was enough to establish a case.
He said he would have taken the offer. I mean, you know, words matter. And, you know, I understand people can say, well, it's C versus W. So what? And maybe the Nevada Supreme Court, looking at it, could have said could is the same as would. But the question is it contrary to clearly established Supreme Court law for the Nevada Supreme Court to say could means could and doesn't mean would?
I think that, Your Honor, the problem goes back to the hearing, if we could call it that, in the district court on Mr. Manciano's post-conviction petition.
Is that in district court now?
No, this is in the state trial court.
So in the state trial court, there was no evidence that there was even an offer. There was no nothing.
But the problem is that the state and the judge prevented that evidence from coming forward. At the hearing, this is in the record starting at page 691, Mr. Kennedy appeared. Mr. Manciano was an improper person. He was not brought to court because he was in prison. The judge denied his request for counsel, but Mr. Kennedy appeared and was trying to let the judge know, hey, there's something going on here. I really want to let you know what happened. And he says, Mr. Kennedy says, I've received a copy of his writ, and there are some points I wouldn't mind putting out before you make a decision on it. If the state wouldn't mind, perhaps you're prepared to make a decision today, but I'd ask if you would allow me a couple weeks to submit an affidavit that may address certain things that are brought out in the petition, if the court would allow. And the district attorney says that, well, you know, it's his trial counsel. He can't file his post-conviction petition, which isn't really what Mr. Kennedy was attempting to do. And the DA says, we disagree that counsel is incompetent. So the court goes on and says, well, I'm not going to appoint a lawyer, and then Mr. Kennedy responds, I'm not coming in on behalf of Mr. Manciano. I'm just coming in to explain what happened, because these things have to do with how I represented him. And the court says, I think I could just make some findings here. Why don't I just do that, and I think that'll take care of it. And let's go through the motions. Motion for appointment of counsel is denied, and then he goes through a few of the other things. And then he says, the allegations against Mr. Kennedy for ineffective assistance of counsel, I've gone through, and it looks to me like Mr. Kennedy has done a very good job, as a matter of fact, representing him in the case, and all the points are made. So I find there's no basis for that whatsoever. So his trial lawyer is there trying to say, hey, judge, I want to talk to you about a few things that I think were problems. And the judge not only doesn't give Mr. Manciano a lawyer to help deal with that or bring him down so he can at least be there to represent himself at this hearing, but he completely cuts Mr. Kennedy off and doesn't allow him to make any of these representations to the court. And we can see from the affidavit that Mr. Kennedy provides that he would have been able to give the court the details of the offer and that he is unsure whether he conveyed that offer to Mr. Manciano, so there really was something to go on.
So how does that fit within the rubric of AEDPA? So we're looking now at the Nevada State Supreme Court opinion, and there the court says appellant again did not offer any specific facts about the nature of the offer. The district court denied this claim on the ground that the record was devoid of any offer and that appellant failed to state he would have taken that offer. Now, how do you fit that within the requirements of AEDPA?
Because Mr. Manciano was never given the opportunity to develop his claim. He had the basis for the claim. He wasn't given the opportunity to develop. So this court does not need to defer to those findings by the Nevada court.
Well, see, he put in an affidavit. I mean, this is the problem. He put in an affidavit to the Nevada Supreme Court.
He did on appeal.
Huh?
I'm sorry. He did on appeal, along with the affidavit from Mr. Kennedy, which was submitted a little bit later.
Yeah, but it doesn't say anything. I mean, it just says that there was an offer, but it doesn't say anything about what he would have done about it. That doesn't require anybody except him. It doesn't require any kind of evidence from somebody else. Take what Kennedy says at face value. I don't know whether I told him or didn't tell him. Okay. Assume he didn't tell him. Assume the absolutely in your client's favor. Kennedy didn't tell him. Obviously, he should have told him. So what difference does it make? And the only person who knows that is Manciano.
Mr. Manciano does say throughout his pleadings that he would or could have taken the offer. I think another important...
Says he could have taken it, which is very different. And, I mean, his affidavit doesn't even say he could have.
But there are points as well where he does say he would have considered the offer, and that's on page 507 of the record.
In the federal court, he did. He tried.
No, that actually is his reply in the state court, I believe, the reply to the state's opposition to his writ in the state court. He uses the word would. He uses them rather interchangeably throughout, too, which is a little confusing. But given that he's a pro se litigant, I think that issue should be weighed in.
Let me ask a question. Are we limited to just what he said in his affidavit, or can we look at the nature of the crimes, what he was charged with, what the potential consequences were, what the weight of the evidence was with respect to the arson versus the murder? Because, you know, my thinking is that it would be completely unreasonable not to take a plea offer of 2 to 10 years for the arson in exchange for getting the murder, attempted murder count dropped, because that was the one that loaded on up to 70 years. And it seemed also from the evidence that there was a lot of evidence as to arson, and that the murder, attempted murder, was a very weak case. So it seems to me if they'd actually had this discussion, it'd be a no-brainer. Just take the 2 to 10 years.
That's right, Your Honor. Mr. Manciano, and I think that's a very important factor to look at here. Not only is Mr. Manciano saying I could have taken the deal in light of the fact that exposure was 70 years, he ultimately got 40. A 2 to 10 is a pretty good deal, and his lawyer should have been having that conversation with him that, you know, this is Nevada and these juries are conservative and this is a deal that you want to think about.
That's the problem here, isn't it? Because he would be speculating about something that didn't happen. For him to say, I would have accepted that offer, puts him in a state of mind of having to say what he would have done about events that never occurred. And so I suppose we do have to grapple with the difference between the words, I could have accepted, which is a truthful thing. He was deprived of that opportunity to even say whether he would have accepted it or not. And I would have accepted it, which is a judgment about what he would have done if something had occurred which didn't occur, which has got to be speculation. And it's a hindsight statement, which he would be making in light of subsequent events, which wouldn't have taken place at the point where he would be saying I would have accepted it. So it's the fundamental problem here is without having informed him about the offer, he was deprived of an opportunity to do anything. And then the question is whether or not that deprivation is so fundamental in light of what happened, and even if we ignore what happened, to the nature of the attorney-client relationship, that it deprived him of a fundamental due process right.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that's why Judge Wardlaw's point was so important, because when we look at what happened in this case, the denial of Mr. Manciano, the fundamental ability to make one of the few decisions defendants get to make is, am I going to plead or am I going to go to trial?
I interpreted it as just the opposite. After he's gotten a 45-year sentence, he sure as heck can easily say, I would have taken a deal if I'd known about it. And he never said it.
Well, but I think that's why it's important to look at where he was.
He testified he was basically full steam ahead on going to trial. That's what he wanted to do. His position was, I didn't do any of this.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's also why it's very important that that people have lawyers, because having an objective person let you know, these are the risks you're facing, this is your option, you may really want to give this some thought, may have changed Mr. Manciano's opinion about that. I mean, he never had the opportunity to make that decision.
I really don't disagree. I mean, there's no question this is deficient performance, on assuming every fact in your favor. The real question is whether the Nevada Supreme Court's determination to the contrary on prejudice runs afoul of clearly established federal constitutional law on prejudice.
And I believe given the lack of opportunity that Mr. Manciano had to develop this case.
Sufficiency. It doesn't show effect on outcome.
There seems to be, people keep referring to saying that Monciano was focused on proceeding to trial, but that's not what the declaration says. The declaration of Kurt Kennedy says that I was very focused on proceeding with this matter to trial.
That's correct.
Nothing about Monciano being hell-bent on going to trial, no matter what.
And Mr. Monciano has indicated that he would have talked to them about an Alford plea. He was insistent that he did not do this, but he has not said, well, you know, I was going to go to trial no matter what, and I wouldn't have considered any other possibility. Very briefly, on the issue of sufficiency, in Nevada, express malice is required. All that's here is a fire, and maybe...
Let me ask you something. All that's here is a fire that started by someone who knows that there are three people sound asleep in a house.
A house that he's in as well.
Well, I understand.
Which I think is a really...
You have to assume the arson now. He knows he set fire to the house, and he can get up and leave anytime he wants to. He doesn't say fire, so if he said fire, get out, then you can figure, well, all he wanted to do was just burn the house down. If he'd tried to get them out, you could say, well, or he was just trying to scare them. But here he sets fire to a house knowing there are three people who are sound asleep and can be asphyxiated, I didn't say that very well, by the smoke. So why doesn't that add up to express malice? What would if it doesn't?
What would? I think if the fire had been set in somebody's bed, that would be pretty good. But here, it's a fire in a garage. The fire burns for about 10 minutes before the people are alerted. It burns for another 10 minutes. It never even makes it into the house. There's some smoke damage in the kitchen. There's nothing in the living room, nothing in the bedrooms. All of the people come out of the house at the same time.
After a neighbor comes and knocks on the door.
Heather Workman testifies that Mr. Manciano is in bed with her when the knock comes on the door, and he does walk out with everybody at the same time. So, there just isn't anything to indicate that he has any intent to do harm to those three people in the house.
Look, I could see a difference between setting fire to the house at, let's say, 3 in the afternoon, knowing that people are in there, cooking, reading, whatever, and setting fire to the house when he did, knowing that they are sound asleep.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, this is 8:30 on a Sunday morning. I'm not sure that that's... And he's in the house, too, which I think is really important that not get lost, is that he's in there, too. So, it kind of doesn't make sense. If he's intending harm to these other people, why would he be there with them? And there has to be some showing. I mean, even in cases where somebody shoots at somebody, there has to be some showing that they actually are intending to kill them over and above just that act. That can't just be the, abandoned malignant heart or a reckless disregard. There has to be some showing above that of the specific intent to harm the people. And I'd like to reserve my last minute for rebuttal.
Surely.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jamie Resch. I'm here on behalf of the Nevada Attorney General's Office for the respondents. I think this case overall is very interesting, in particular the plea offer issue, and we've heard a lot of the main points that were raised in that issue, but I'd like to go through a couple of things anyway. It was raised as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and I realize that the Court's focus primarily on the prejudice prong of the Strickland test, but I don't want to concede the objectively unreasonable actions of counsel just yet. Obviously, if the offer was made and he didn't tell Manciano about it, that would be objectively unreasonable. And what Manciano was or wasn't told is obviously something that's between him and his attorney. There'll be no way to peer into that other than what the two of them have said. But the finding of fact that we discussed earlier at the state habeas proceeding was that there was no offer. No evidence was presented by Manciano of any offer at that time, even though he apparently knew about it as early as the preliminary hearing in his case.
How do you respond to counsel's argument? How do you respond to counsel's argument that Mr. Kennedy showed up and wanted to talk about that issue with at the district court, but the district court wouldn't let him?
Well, I have two thoughts on that. One is that Manciano knew what the offer was because he was told before the preliminary hearing. So if he wanted to put the context of that offer into a state habeas petition, there was nothing stopping him from doing so. In fact, what he did is put the vaguest representation of this claim at any point in time was in the state habeas proceeding. He says there was a possible offer that he may have considered if he had been told about it. So I think
what
some of what...
Talking about when you're talking about before the preliminary hearing, which preliminary hearing?
Well, in Nevada, there's a preliminary hearing before you proceed to trial. And if I'm recalling correctly, what Manciano says in his affidavit to the Nevada Supreme Court is that it was at that time that a public defender informed him of the substance of this offer, which apparently mirrors what he's claiming it currently was, that it was 2 to 10 years in exchange for a plea to the arson charge and the attempted murder charges would be dismissed. So it appears to me that he knew that at the time that he prepared a state habeas petition. If he was serious about that offer, or if, I guess my point is, it really existed, what he could have done is put it into his state habeas petition and presented it to the court at that time. The other thing is that, you're right, Kirk Kennedy, his trial counsel, was at that hearing. And, you know, there's two ways to look at it, obviously. But I think that if he had a strong notion that this offer was made and he wanted to tell the court about it, there was nothing stopping him from doing that. He didn't say anything about it at that time. It's only down the road that this claim continues to develop and becomes more, the factual predicate for the claim develops as we go along. It's when he gets to the Nevada Supreme Court, suddenly, oh, well, here's the substance of the claim. It's 2 to 10 years, and I'll enter my plea to arson. And that's the claim that he repeats to the federal district court.
Would you have us assume that this was all made up, that there was no offer?
Well, this is part of my pitch on the objectively unreasonable part of Strickland, is that, yes, the state court finding of fact was that Manciano failed to show that there even was an offer. And
but
AEDPA, the presumption is going to be that that's the fact of the case.
All right. But is that true?
If there was communication between the two of them, there's no way to peer into that. That's something that would be between his attorney and him.
There's a hearing that could be held.
Well, that would not help us because we know what the two of them are going to say. We have his trial counsel put an affidavit, says he doesn't remember if he conveyed an offer.
We have the opportunity to cross-examine.
That's true, but, you know, even cross-examine him, his answer is still going to be, I don't remember. That's what he says the claim is.
But there's another witness that would be called, namely the person who made the offer. That evidence was, that's potential evidence that could be presented, as well as the evidence of the person who received the offer. Now, not only one, but two.
Okay.
And the question of whether or not it was communicated. All of that would be before the court in an evidentiary hearing, wouldn't it?
Yes, and those points make sense. I guess my only concern would be that that factual predicate would have been known to Manciano. He knew who his public defender was at the time of the preliminary hearing. That all should have been in the state habeas petition if he wanted to develop that factual record, and
but
he did.
Was that his lawyer at the time? I thought that the record was that this person came to him as someone appointed, and he says, no, 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 you do not represent me. I have a lawyer. So he never heard an offer from someone who was his lawyer.
Well, if the way I read his affidavit was that, in fact, he did have the public defender at that point, said, I'm hiring a private attorney. I don't want to discuss this with you. But at that point in time, that the public defender was, in fact, his attorney. And from what we have from Manciano, he was conveyed the offer at that time. He knew what the predicate for it was, and he just chose, for whatever reason, not to put it in the state court proceedings. And then we end up with a finding of fact from the state habeas court that there was no evidence that an offer was ever made. And Manciano's continued to improve his claim at each step of the way until
Let's be fair. I mean, he didn't have representation, and then he got representation. And obviously, the development of the claim would improve with having a lawyer than being pro se.
Of course it would improve. If you bring an attorney into it, you know, you reach a better way of saying it. But there is no right to counsel in these types of proceedings, so that isn't something we should presume against him, per se. It's simply a matter of, I'm simply saying that he knew the facts.
But then we should also not infer that the development of the claim means that it was originally false and now it's being trying to be better. That we shouldn't infer that either, right?
Well, no, and this is, you know, part of these issues were raised in a motion to dismiss, that the concern was that it was unexhausted, that continuing to change the claim so much to some point leads us to the point where just the factual basis for the claim hasn't been presented to the state Supreme Court.
It does seem that the state Supreme Court did not have the factual basis. It just relied on what the district court had found, that there was no evidence of an offer, which we actually, from all this evidence, it does seem like there was at least an offer.
Well, again, I'm not in a position where I want to agree with that necessarily. Manciano is the one saying that, and, you know, I take it for what it is. Now, the courts obviously went the easier way, and I realize I'm making the more difficult argument here, to look at the prejudice prong of the whole scenario, and I can certainly take a look at that right now. The concern, the first thing that pops out, obviously, is his use of the word could instead of the word would, and I didn't want to get into a gigantic English lesson here today. The concern is simply, if you reword it a little bit, take a look at a different ineffective type of claim. Now, if he said, well, my trial counsel didn't object to something that happened at trial, and if he had, I could have been found not guilty. It sounds entirely speculative when you view it in that kind of context. And I heard the discussion earlier, and I guess I would just leave it at could is not the same as would, that even if there is some instance where you could interchange those two words, they are not 100% interchangeable. And under AEDPA, the rule is, if there's a gray area that the Nevada Supreme Court's opinion could have ended up in, and it did, and they applied Strickland, we defer to that decision. And I think,
can you ever use, I would have accepted something that you never knew about?
Well, towards where this is going, I don't want to say that these types of errors are structural. I think they clearly are not. This isn't the first time this has come up before the Ninth Circuit where someone claims I wasn't told about an offer. And we have Blaylock, and I think Jones was cited in our answer. And those cases went into the whole, well, what would you have done? You still need to affirmatively show prejudice if you want to satisfy Strickland. I would just suggest that could does not do that.
It's such an artificial kind of rubric, because if you have a good lawyer, they're going to have read Blaylock and they're going to say, you know, put in your affidavit, would. And if you don't have any lawyer and you may not have read Blaylock or understood what, you know, that you have to say would instead of could. I mean, it's just an artificial constraint that doesn't really tell us anything about the truth.
Well, I would suggest it's English. You know, there's a proper usage of these words. There's no evidence that Manciano doesn't know what he's talking about. A lot of his filings were gigantic. I mean, he had 30, 40 claims to originally begin with here.
What's his educational background? Is he a person that would know those terms are not to be used interchangeably?
I would think so. You know, on the one hand, he has experience with the criminal justice system. This isn't the first conviction he's endured. Taking a look at his...
Is that in the record? I was trying to find out if this was his first conviction.
I think that...
So anything before that?
Probably. No, he had the... there was a manslaughter conviction out of California. I think some of the documents pertaining to that were in a motion to correct an illegal sentence. I did see him in the record. I could try and find them for the court if you want.
Yeah, I'd appreciate a record cite to that.
Okay. May I follow up with a letter, or do you want me to do it now?
No, not right now. Just do it afterwards and send it in with the...
Okay. The other thing is that the presentation of this claim happened all along. At state habeas, he says, you know, I could have considered the claim. Says the same thing all the way along. Well, he has the opinion from the state trial court, and he has the opinion from the Nevada Supreme Court by the time he gets to federal court, and they both say the same thing. You didn't say you would have accepted this offer. So it's hard for me to agree that at this point that he's...
Is it necessary to say I would have accepted it? Or I would have considered it.
Well, I realize in his reply at the state habeas level, he says, I would have considered it. To me, that is exactly the same thing as saying I could have taken the offer. The only thing he's saying he would do is think about it. And that doesn't affirmatively show prejudice.
Well, he was deprived of the opportunity to think about it.
Again, I don't believe these are structural errors, so we need to perform that analysis. And I realize that this is potentially a difficult claim for someone in my position. If he had said would, there would be a much more difficult discussion. But thankfully, I'm prepared to go a little step further and suppose that, you know, if we wanted to dig deeper, see what he really was thinking when he said could, is there any chance that he was confused and meant would? I don't think there is, based on the record.
But let me ask you, I mean, when the charges were brought, it seems to me that, I mean, again, I it just seems from the record that I have, that the murder, attempted murder, was a weaker case. To prove.
Okay.
To prove. Then the arson. And sometimes an indictment would be written to have some additional charges that maybe are not as strong as others for the purpose of bargaining.
Okay, yeah,
right?
Certainly.
And I'm sure you've done that yourself.
Yeah, well, we only bring charges supported by evidence, of course.
Right, even the weakest of evidence. So it seems to me it would be crazy not to accept the 2-10 for arson, given the and take the gamble on the murder.
Well,
charges, which would increase the sentence, right? By
agreed, but you know, under the Ninth Circuit precedent, what we need to consider is not what he would do today, not with the benefit of hindsight. What did he want to do at the time? Is
no,
where the
I'm,
focus
I'm
has
saying
got
at
to
the
be.
Time.
Yeah,
it would
well,
be crazy,
and,
given
and
his situation.
One thing that has not changed in his entire presentation of this claim is his steadfast claims of innocence, that he has never once suggested that he would even plead guilty to these charges. His talk is always of an Alford plea, which, by the way, there is no evidence that the offer encompassed an ability to plead to Alford. The understanding would be that maybe the state would be willing to take a guilty plea. He's never once suggested that the state would not only cut him this wonderful deal in light of the charges and evidence against him, but also allow him to avoid having to admit his guilt in open court. But my concern is that the allegation is that he never alleges that he would actually plead guilty.
That's sort of punishing him for what may be very candid honesty, because what he's saying, as I understand it, is, I don't know what I would have done, because it never got to the point where something was presented to me as an option. And if you tell me that I need to now declare what I would have done if an option had been presented to me and ignore what ultimately happened to me, that's a very difficult burden for me to carry. All that he has to prove is reasonable probability that it would have made a difference. Reasonable probability. And if he says, having it in front of me, I could have then made an informed decision, but my lawyer deprived me of that ability, that's as far as he can go. If he says, I would have accepted it, why wouldn't that be subject to an attack on credibility grounds? Oh, of course you say it now, but was that true then?
Well,
and so it's a disingenuous situation. He's caught between a dilemma that cannot ever go in his favor.
Again, this is not a unique claim. The Ninth Circuit has passed on this type of thing at least twice in the last decade. And the concern is that he has to affirmatively show prejudice, and that just hasn't happened where he's claimed from the beginning of time that I didn't do this. Even to this day in federal court, he claims, I am innocent. I did not do this, but
can't
I would
deny
have
him that presumption and the plea, though.
Well, pursuant to Alford, but there's no proof, there's no allegation at any point that the state was willing to take an Alford plea in this type of case. And I guess just to respond to your question a little further, the concern is still that there is no structural error in this type of thing. He still needs to affirmatively show prejudice, and he hasn't done that at this point. So to sum up that argument, I suppose I would say that we're applying Strickland. The Nevada Supreme Court did that. So the concern is, well, was that an objectively unreasonable application of that? I don't think it was. Strickland clearly refers to affirmatively showing prejudice, and it just hasn't happened in this case.
Let's talk about the uncertified issue.
Yes,
uncertified. Okay. Reading the Nevada Supreme Court order dismissing the direct appeal.
Okay.
There's no mention of the attempted murder charge specifically at all. And in reading the rationale for finding sufficiency of the evidence, I think I find one line that maybe possibly could be deemed to be a statement from which you could infer a deliberate intent to kill, and that's when the court says he was completely dressed and was carrying two bags. But that's it.
Okay.
Now, is that sufficient to show deliberate intent?
Well, I recall the opinion. I don't have it here right in front of me, but I think there is another line where they talk about that the Manleys were awakened by a neighbor with news that their house is on fire. And
it says, when the Manleys were awakened with the news that their house was on fire, the three members of the Manley family quickly left the house in various stages of undress.
Right. But the primary point of all that is that they were sleeping and their house is on fire, the fire having been started by Manciano.
No, it also says, appellant. However, although appellant left the house with the Manleys, so the court does acknowledge that appellant left the house at the same time.
No, I don't disagree. It was around the same time. There was a big debate in the record of who left first.
Right, but the court is saying that deliberate intent can be inferred solely from the fact that he was wearing shorts, a shirt, and slip-on shoes and was carrying his two bags. And that's it. That's what the court says.
Yeah, I guess I read it slightly more expansively, that the deliberate intent to kill comes from the fact that these people were sleeping and that their house was started on fire by Manciano. I think it encompasses that, obviously not in the clearest language that could ever be written, but the facts to support that inference are mentioned in there, and it's obviously part of the record.
I think, though, that there'd be something specific on deliberate intent when we're talking about the charge that constitutes the reason for this greatest portion of his sentence.
I understand, and it's hard for me to stand here and say, well, the Nevada Supreme Court should have worded that better, but perhaps they should have included that. But who knew?
It's sufficiently worded so that it meets the AEDPA standard.
Yes, I believe so. The record is obviously chock full of evidence that these people were sleeping when the house was started on fire. The opinion makes reference to that fact, albeit in a slightly oblique way, but it is there. And based on that, we're able to say, all right, they applied a state court case that uses Jackson v. Virginia. They applied the correct standard and evaluated the evidence and concluded that there was sufficient evidence on all charges. I think that's how they conclude. So, no, they didn't break out the attempted murder separately from the arson charge, but I think they said enough to cover all of the charges that were brought in the case.
So you think under Nevada law, deliberate intent can be shown by the fact that he was dressed and had his bags when he came out of the house with the rest of them?
I believe that under Nevada law, deliberate intent to kill can be inferred from the fact that he started this house on fire and that he knew the people were sleeping inside it, and that the Nevada Supreme Court opinion that you're looking at encompasses those facts, not in as clear a sense as I just said them, but clearly mention is made to them.
Do you think it's reasonably debatable?
Not reasonably debatable, no, especially considering the fact that the Nevada Supreme Court had the record of what happened at trial before it when it considered these things. It's apparent what their decision was based upon. I find it to be a reasoned decision on the merits, so to speak, but that would be my view of it, of course. let me pass one more thing on the severity of what happened. You know, to have an attempted murder charge, I don't think you should peer into the whole, well, what was the harm? You know, there's some talk of, well, maybe the house didn't burn all that much, or it was started in the garage, not the bedrooms, for example. But same sort of thing, if you do fire a gun at someone, and let's say you miss, well, they're not hurt at all. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't a deliberate intent to kill. When he went and did these things, started the garage on fire, it was, you know, the garage was consumed in flames by the time the fire department arrived, and I think there's a reasonable inference that the house would have continued to burn, obviously, if not for the arrival of the fire department, which was predicated by the happenstance notice of a neighbor coming and waking everybody up. So I believe there's sufficient evidence of intent to kill, clearly enough that any rational trier of fact under Jackson v. Virginia could so infer, and that's exactly what happened in this case. Therefore, there should be no granting of any habeas relief. If there's nothing further, I'll conclude.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Resch.
Thank you.
I just have a couple points. Judge Wardlaw, to answer your question, Mr. Manciano had a GED. His pre-sentence investigation report is found at page 741 of the record, and the GED part's on page 745. There is no...
What's that?
He didn't graduate from high school. He took a test to get a diploma.
Okay. But what about the reference to a prior manslaughter?
He pled guilty to manslaughter after a series of very unfortunate events that is explained in detail in the pre-sentence report, where his infant daughter was killed by a babysitter, and then he was in a fight later on and stabbed somebody. It's sort of all tied in together, but he pled guilty to a manslaughter and was given a sentence of 3 years. Also, the record does not reflect the public defender represented Mr. Manciano. At most, they would have made one appearance, an initial appearance with him. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Phil. Thank you, counsel. The matter just argued will be submitted, and the court will be adjourned.